So today we're going to finish the computation we started last week. So remember, our goal for the last few lectures has been to try to compute observables like a cross-section or decay rate. And what we saw last week was, well, we did part of the computation. We related a cross-section or decay rate to a, I'm skipping a few steps here. We related that to the time-ordered product of fields in a vacuum expectation value. So first, what we did was we related this to the S matrix element, and then we related this to this vacuum expectation value of the time-ordered product of fields. And today, we're going to try to compute this. So we're going to do that in two steps. So the first thing we're going to do, we're going to go to the interaction picture and relate this time-ordered product of Heisenberg picture fields. So recall that phi sub 1 means the field operator phi evaluated at the space-time point x1. And what we're going to do is relate that to essentially a similar expression, but involving the time-ordered product of free fields. And a vacuum expectation value with a free vacuum. So this, the difference between these two expressions is this is a expression in the Heisenberg picture for an interacting field operator. And what we'll see is we can relate that, if we write that in the interaction picture, it essentially becomes a vacuum expectation value of free fields. So the interaction picture fields, as we'll discuss, are essentially behave in exactly the same way as the free fields we discussed at the beginning of last week. And we can compute this vacuum expectation value by relating it to the simplest non-trivial vacuum expectation value, which is the vacuum expectation value of the time-ordered product of two fields. And we'll do this using Wick's theorem, which we'll write and derive in a very different way from what you've seen in your statistical physics course. So they're, of course, entirely equivalent, but the natural way to think about Wick's theorem in the canonical formulation is quite different from what you've already seen in the statistical physics course. And finally, we will compute this object. So once we've computed this object, we can follow this chain backwards and compute any observable way. Okay. So we're going to work in the interaction picture. And the idea behind the interaction picture is we break up our Hamiltonian into two parts. Some part we can solve exactly. In our case, this will be the Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon theory, and some perturbation. So we're going to add, so we might be interested in a scalar field theory that has additional terms in the Lagrangian, which will give rise to additional terms in the Hamiltonian, like that a self-interaction term, like a phi cubed or phi to the fourth term. And that will give us some additional term, and we won't be able to solve a theory exactly, but what we'll see is we can solve it perturbatively by going to the interaction picture. So think of H naught as the Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian, and H1 as any other part of the Hamiltonian. I just want to briefly recall some of the key differences between the Heisenberg, Schrodinger, and interaction picture. So in the Heisenberg picture, our states are constant, and our operators evolve in time, and they just evolve like e to the i h I'm going to do something a little bit different from what you may have seen. So this formula, I'm going to insert a T naught. So you may be used to choosing the reference time at which the Heisenberg and Schrodinger pictures agree to be sometime T naught equals zero. I'm going to leave this time to be arbitrary. We'll make some of our future discussion a little bit simpler, or more transparent, rather. So this should be a familiar formula with T naught equals zero, but I'm going to include that T naught just to make some of our future discussion a little bit more transparent. In contrast, in the Schrodinger picture, the states evolve in time. So they can, I'm going to insert this reference time T naught, and the operators are constant. Time independent. So, and then the time T naught is the time at which the Heisenberg and Schrodinger pictures agree, both the states and the operators. The interaction picture is somewhere in between. So what we're going to, what we assume in the interaction picture is that the states evolve just with the free Hamiltonian. E to the I H naught T minus T naught compared to the Heisenberg, to the Schrodinger picture states. And the interaction picture operators just evolve with the free Hamiltonian. And there's another way we can write the interaction picture states. So this is the Schrodinger picture state, and if we're going to write it in terms of the Heisenberg picture state is just this time-independent state. So we can pull out this time dependence, and we're going to write this as e to the I h naught t minus t naught times e to the minus I h t minus t naught. And in general, h naught and h don't commute, so we can't just combine this, write that as h naught. So note that all three pictures agree at the time t equals t naught. We just said t equals to t naught, all of these exponential factors just disappear, and both the states and the operators are the same in all three pictures. So we've discussed both the Heisenberg and the Schrodinger picture in the free theory. But what we're most interested in doing is relating this time-ordered product of fields in the Heisenberg picture to the interaction picture. So that's why this last equality is useful, because we know this expression that we derived on Friday is in the Heisenberg picture. So what we want to do is relate our Heisenberg picture expression for this vacuum expectation value. We want to relate that to an interaction picture expression. So there's two things we need to do in order to relate this Heisenberg picture expression to a interaction picture expression. First, we need to write the fields in the interaction picture, and then we need to write the vacuum in the interaction picture. So the Heisenberg picture field can be written in terms of the interaction picture field, e to the so we have here this expression, and we want to relate it to this expression. So both of these involve O, and we can solve for this Schrodinger picture operator by basically multiplying by e to the minus iht and e to the plus iht on both sides. So what we get is this expression. Where this is the interaction picture field. And this combination shows up quite a bit, e to the ih times e to the minus ih naught. And as we discussed in the quantum theory course, there's another useful way to write this. We can also write this as a time evolution operator in the interaction picture. So this operator U, we can think of as an operator that evolves, time evolves from a reference time T naught to a final time T. And since this shows up a lot, I'm going to introduce a shorthand notation for this. So I'll call it U. 2-1 to be the time evolution operator, interaction picture time evolution operator from the time t1 to time t2. And this is just the time-ordered exponential of e to the minus I times the integral t1 to t2 of h, the interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture, which I'll write as h 1i at t prime. So I hope this expression is familiar to you from the quantum theory course. So here this is the interaction picture, interaction Hamiltonian. And this is the same time ordering symbol that we discussed on Friday. So this is a time evolution operator. And that means a few things. One is that if we time evolve for no time, that should be the identity. Second, it should be unitary. U inverse should be U 2-1 dagger. But U 2-1 inverse should be the same. It evolve forward in time and evolve backwards for the same time interval, that should be the same thing. So it should also be equal to U12. And furthermore, we should be able to time evolve for some time from some time t1 to t2, and then from t2 to t3, and that should give us the same thing as u31. So these are properties we expect, and you can check that they all follow from this definition.
What is
Hamiltonian?
Just h1, what is the meaning?
H1 refers to the interaction part of the Hamiltonian. So I'm calling this part the free Hamiltonian, and this is the interaction Hamiltonian. And the I indicates that this Hamiltonian is in the interaction picture. We could write the Hamiltonian in any of the three pictures, and we have principal different expression.
So that time ordering symbol over there means that the interaction Hamiltonian inside has to be time ordered?
That's right. So yes, what it means that any operators that appear to the right of this time ordering symbol should appear in time order. So the way the exponential is defined is through its Taylor series. So if we Taylor expand this exponential, we'll have powers of h evaluated at different times. And this time ordering symbol means that we may need to reorder some of those the operators in like the h squared term or the h cubed term, because if we just directly expand the exponential, the operators won't necessarily appear in a time ordered manner. And we'll see that explicitly. We will expand this in terms of the Taylor series later in the lecture.
So I still don't understand how you got the bar phi, the expression, the first expression in the blackboard.
This one?
Yeah, I mean, I know that you're using like the Heisenberg operators formula, but then I don't see how you get it.
Okay, so this is Heisenberg. This is the Heisenberg picture. So we have two formulas here we have a formula for the Heisenberg picture operator, and we have a picture here for the interaction picture operator. They both involve the Schrodinger picture operator. So I'm writing an expression for the Heisenberg picture operator. I can write, and this involves O, so I can change this formula into, this tells us that O is e to the multiplied by minus I h naught t minus t naught times O I of t times e to the plus I h naught t minus t naught. And I can plug this in here, and that should be what I've got. So we can basically directly relate the fields in the Heisenberg picture and the interaction picture. So the other thing we need to do if we want to write this expression for the vacuum expectation value of Heisenberg picture fields in the interaction picture is we need to relate the vacuum in the Heisenberg picture to the vacuum in the interaction picture. So if we want to compute vacuum expectation value, we need to relate these two vacuum. So that's what we're going to try to determine next. And so what do we know about the different vacuum states? So in our derivation of the LSE reduction formula, we assumed that we act with the annihilation operator at any time, but in particular at the reference time, on our vacuum state, in principle has some time dependence, we should get zero. And that's essentially how we defined our annihilation operators, said that those the annihilation operators are ones that annihilate the vacuum state at any time. And well, this is true at any time, but in particular, it should be true for t equals plus or minus infinity. And we can rewrite this, rewrite the same equation in this slightly different form. We can rewrite this as e to the minus I h t minus t naught times omega equals zero. So now this is the Schrodinger picture, the Heisenberg picture vacuum state. So that here the vacuum is in the Schrodinger picture, and here it's in the Heisenberg picture. This is the Heisenberg picture vacuum. That's what we want. And what else do we know? We also know that if we act with AP, the annihilation operator, on the free vacuum state, we get zero. And so let's rewrite that in the Heisenberg picture. If we write we get AP of T naught times e to the minus I H naught T minus T naught be zero. And well, let's compare these two expressions. So T naught. So at the time t equals t naught, all three pictures agree. So the annihilation operators in the interaction, in an interacting theory, should be the same as the in the Heisenberg picture. Should be the same as the annihilation operators in the interaction picture. At time t equals t naught, but the annihilation operators in the interaction picture, if we're an interacting theory, are the same as the annihilation operators in a free theory, because the operators in the interaction picture have exactly the same time dependence as the annihilation operators in the free theory. And we assume that the only thing that could change for the equation annihilation operators when we go from a free theory to an interacting theory is their time dependence. So these operators really have to be the same thing. And if we make the further assumption that the vacuum state is unique, then there should only then this state and this state have to be the same, at least up to some normalization. If we assume the vacuum is unique, there should be only a single state up to normalization that is annihilated by all of the annihilation operators. So these two states should be proportional. So if we make the further assumption that the vacuum is unique, then we have that e to the I h t minus t naught acting on omega should be proportional to e to the minus I h naught t minus t naught acting on zero. the proportional, they should equal up to some constant. And if we compare these two expressions as t goes to plus or minus infinity, we'll get the most useful relationship between these two. So we can write that omega is equal to some normalization, which I'll call an I, as t goes to plus minus infinity, of e to the I h t minus t naught e to the minus I h naught t minus t naught and t on 0. Which, in another way of writing this, is ni times u 0 negative infinity at t on 0. And similarly, I can also relate omega to zero. Instead of taking t to minus infinity, I could take t to plus infinity, and I can relate the bra omega to the bra zero. Like this. And in general, nf doesn't have to be equal to ni, because these factors out front will be, in general, different as we go to plus or minus infinity. Yes? So this is in the free theory. So this is in the interacting theory that we're interested in. This is in the free theory. But the argument I made is that these operators at this particular time are the same in the interacting theory and in the free theory. And with this further assumption, we can make a relationship between those states. So these are in different theories. So this is in free theory. And this is in the interacting theory.
So in the interacting, both of them are, the first line is the Schrodinger picture, and the second one is the Heisenberg picture. You're, in any moment, you're not using the interaction picture, right?
That's right.
Yeah, it's just that it's kind of confusing because it is called also interacting theory, and you have interaction picture. Yeah.
Yes. Unfortunately, there's no other commonly used word to describe both. Okay. So we've related both the states and the operators in the expression we're trying to compute between the Heisenberg picture and the interaction picture. So all that's left to do is combine our results what we're interested in computing is this time ordered product sandwiched between the vacuum state and using our results, we can write this as and to save a little bit of writing, I'm going to for now assume that these fields are time ordered. I'll assume t1 is greater than t2, greater than tn. So this is equal to omega. In that case, the time ordering does nothing. And we can now plug in our results. So we've got two normalization constants. Then we have 0 u infinity to zero from this expression. Then if we write our Heisenberg picture fields in the interaction picture and write them as this one as u 0 1 times the interaction picture field, which I'll write as phi naught of x1 u 1 0. Then similarly for all the other fields, so we have a u 0 2 phi 0 u 2 0 and so on up to the end. We'll have a u 0 n y 0 x n u n 0, and then at the end a u 0 minus infinity coming from here. Yeah, that's a long expression, but I've just not working. Can you see this line? Could you see if I wrote another line, or should I move to a different board? Different board. Okay. Okay. So continuing the same calculation before, that's equal to. So what we're computing was this. We can then combine many of these factors using these two relations. So, for example, over here we're evolving from time 2 to time 0, and then from 0 to 1. So that's the same as evolving from time 2 to time 1. So many of these factors just combine. And what we get is Ni and F 0 u infinity 1 phi naught x1 u 1 2 all the way up to u n minus 1 n phi naught of x n u n minus infinity. Okay. And this is already time ordered, so we can just insert the time ordering symbol back here and get the same thing. And the time ordering symbol lets us rearrange any of the operators that appear to its right, because this time ordering symbol gives us a prescription for what order the operators should appear in. So I can collect all of the operators, and they all combine very nicely. I'm using this composition property. So u infinity 1 combines with u 1 2, which will combine with u 2 3, etc., and we'll be left with an I and F 0 times T phi naught of x1 up to phi naught of xn u infinity minus infinity. We just have a single time evolution operator that's a time evolution operator from the far past to the far future. Okay. So this is a relationship between Heisenberg picture expression and the interaction picture expression. Only thing left to do is compute this NINF. That'll put this relationship in a more useful form. And to compute NINF, we can make the assumption that the vacuum state is normalized, unit normalized. And if we compute the vacuum state in the interaction picture using our expressions from before over here, the omega, the norm of omega is just ni and f times 0 u infinity minus infinity 0. So that tells us that ni and f should be 1 over u infinity minus infinity 0. And so combining this relation, we get our final expression for the vacuum expectation value we're interested in. And I'm going to write out explicitly what the time evolution operators are in terms of time ordered exponentials. So we get t of phi naught x1 up to phi naught of xn exponential of minus I integral from minus infinity to infinity of h1 I t prime zero, and there's a denominator that comes from this relation, which is just the time ordered exponential vacuum expectation value. And so this is the expression that relates the vacuum expectation value we got in the LSE formula to one that we can actually compute. Because this expression just involves interaction picture fields. Interaction picture fields evolve in time just like free fields. So we know how to, we'll see how to compute these. This object shortly, and it's something we can do in a straightforward manner. We can simplify this a little bit more in practice, it's easier to write the interaction Hamiltonian in terms of the interaction picture fields. And that turns out to be very simple to do in practice. So for example, we could suppose that H1 of T was just integral of some interaction term, say phi to the fourth of x and t. And you want to write this in the interaction picture. This just gives us an e to the pi h naught t minus t naught times this integral. Which is exactly the same. So we can we go to the interaction picture for this operator. We can also rewrite that as the interaction picture. Sorry, this should be T naught. Relate that to the interaction picture for each of these fields, because we just insert factors of e to the I h naught times e to the minus I h naught in here, and we could rewrite each of these field up like phi, instead of thinking of this phi the fourth as phi times phi times phi, in here we can insert e to the plus I h naught times e to the minus I h naught, and we'll get exactly the time dependence for each of these fields. So h the functional form of h1i is exactly the same as the functional form of h1. And so going to go to the interaction picture, basically we can just replace the Heisenberg picture fields with interaction picture fields.
We probably use the fact that exponent, like that, because I would say if we go with our interaction picture, we would have an exponential of the total Hamiltonian.
That's right. So that's where this integral over space comes from. The Hamiltonian density would just be without this integral. Is that what you were asking?
It was really with the operators. When we go to the second, what we do is making the link between interacting picture for H1 with the Heisenberg picture, which is H1 we wrote just here.
Yes, this is the Heisenberg picture.
And this would involve the total Hamiltonian.
I'm assuming the separation still works when we go to the interaction picture. It should, if we can write the Hamiltonian as a sum of two terms, then that's going from one picture to the other should preserve that separation. So, in other words, if you can, you can also write this time evolution operator instead of as this exponential. We can use the fact that h1i has the same functional form as h1, and if we assume there's no derivatives, then the difference between the interaction Hamiltonian and the interaction Lagrangian will just be a relative minus sign. So we can combine, rewrite this integral over time, and the Hamiltonian is an integral over space. We're going to write that as a four-dimensional integral over space-time. of the interaction Hamiltonian, the interaction Lagrangian. Express as a function of the interaction picture fields. And so instead of writing this as an integral with a minus sign over the interaction Hamiltonian, we can write this expression. Rewrite it. Slightly different form. Which will just save us one step. And this form of writing it is nice because it's in a nice Lorentz invariance form already. And often when we specify theory, we specify the Lagrangian instead of the Hamiltonian. So this expression, which is equivalent to the one above, is just slightly easier to use in practice.
That expression, all the fields are in the interaction picture?
That's right. Yes. That's what the subscript zero means. And so to proceed any further than this, we need to use perturbation theory. So in most cases, it's very difficult to directly evaluate these expectation values with an exponential. The exponentials are defined in terms of their Taylor series, and evaluating any given term in a Taylor series is something we can do. So if we Taylor expand each of these exponentials, what we'll get is, assuming our interaction Lagrangian is just some polynomial in the fields, each of the terms in the series expansion will just be the vacuum expectation value of some time-ordered product of fields. So we can evaluate we write the exponential of I times the integral of the Lagrangian as 1 plus I times integral L plus I times integral L mathematically squared. All right, interaction part. Each term will just involve evaluating a term like this. Where this vacuum expectation value will generally involve more fields than the one we're interested in computing in the Heisenberg picture. So each term in the series expansion will be like this. So each term in both the numerator and denominator. So that's what we'll learn how to compute with using Wick's theorem after break.
Oh, I just missed the last part. You said each term's going to look.
So if we expand both the numerator and the denominator using this idea, generally These interaction Lagrangians are polynomials in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
So each term in the numerator and denominator after this expansion will involve n fields for this term, n fields plus, say there's four terms in the, this is four fields in the interaction Lagrangian, then the first term in the perturbation series would involve n plus four terms. So all of these, that's why I put a subscript m here.
Oh. Okay.
So if we're trying to compute this expectation value for, say, n equals four would be a common case, we might need to compute expectation values of this form for arbitrarily large m. We want to go to higher order perturbation. Yes.
About this density Lagrangian, maybe you said it, but we go from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian. So does that say something on boundary conditions at infinity? What do we need to? Because we may have if we do just the transformation from Hamiltonian to Lagrangian, we also have a term with the momentum.
Yes. So in this, going from this line to this line, I assume that our interaction Lagrangian doesn't involve any derivatives, so it's going to be independent of the momentum.
Yeah,
so in that case, it's just a simple.
It's just a zero. Okay.
We could, up until that point, I mean, no assumptions about the form of the interaction. So. In practice, that's the case we're most often interested in. So specialized to that case or not. Other questions? So the way to compute each of the terms in both the numerator and the denominator of this expression is using Wick's theorem. So Wick's theorem tells us is that the time order product of free fields, or equivalently interaction picture fields. Interaction picture fields behave just like free fields. Time ordered product of fields is equal to the normal ordering of the sum of all possible contractions. So what a contraction means is a contraction is a pairing of two fields. So contraction, we have two fields, phi naught of x1 and phi naught of x2. We indicate that they're contracted by drawing a line either above or below them. And this is equal, it's defined to be the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of those two fields. So this is the definition of what this contraction means. And all possible contractions includes partial contractions. So this will include terms with zero or one or two all the way up to the floor of n over two contractions, m. And this is a statement about operators. So notice I haven't done a vacuum expectation value here. But it's in practice, we're most interested in using it inside of a vacuum expectation value. And the nice thing about normal ordering is that the vacuum expectation value of anything, any normal ordered operator is zero if it contains any creation or annihilation operators. In other words, it's not already just a number. So the normal ordering eliminates all partially contracted terms in the vacuum expectation value.
Could you explain contraction in that line?
This is just a definition so far. We're going to compute this. But for an example of what this means, of all possible ways to contract. So for example, we apply Wick's theorem to three field operators. This says that this should be equal to the normal ordering of all possible contractions. So there's one. And I'm going to go back to the old notation where this is just phi 1, this is phi 2, to save some writing. So there is one possible way to contract the fields is not to contract anything. So we've got a term here where it's just phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. There's also a term where phi 1 and phi 2 are contracted. There's a term where phi 1 and phi 3 are contracted. And there is a term where phi 2 and phi 3 are contracted. So there are four possible contractions for three fields. We took a vacuum expectation value of this expression, the right-hand side would vanish because none of the terms on the right-hand side are completely contracted because there's an odd number of fields. So here, none of the fields are contracted. Here, phi 3 is uncontracted, phi 2 is uncontracted, phi 1 is uncontracted. So the vacuum expectation value of each of the terms here vanishes.
What do the colons represent?
These represent normal ordering. This is normal ordering. And again, there's two ways to think about normal ordering. Normal ordering, you think about as moving all of the annihilation operators to the right, creation operators to the left. Or you can think about it as if you have a non-trivial operator, the vacuum expectation value. The normal ordering is subtracting off the vacuum expectation value. So the vacuum expectation value zero vanishes.
So by contraction, you just mean normal sort of like inner products of these fields?
I mean replacing this combination of field operators with this function. We're going to compute this near the end of lecture, and we'll see that this is just an ordinary function. So it's a number, it's not an operator.
What was the last argument you made regarding two of the fields are contracted in that expression, in the final expression, but one is left, so what happens?
So we replaced the operators phi 1 and phi 2 with this function, but phi 3 is still an operator. And if we take the vacuum expectation value of
the normal order phi 3.
Normal ordering of phi 3, we get zero. Because phi 3 contains both creation and annihilation operators.
In the second line, what is the difference between we contract from the other side?
There's no difference. In the future, I will sometimes contract above and sometimes contract below just to make it visually more clear. And I just wanted to point out that those mean exactly the same thing. There's no difference. Okay, so I'm going to sketch a proof. Of Lick's theorem, so we can see why it's true. So the first thing we want to do if we want to try to prove this theorem is separate out the field operators into the creation parts containing the creation operators and parts containing the annihilation operators. After all, normal ordering just reorders the creation parts containing creation operators and annihilation operators. So it's useful to separate out those two parts. And I'm going to define an operator by sub plus of x to be the part containing the creation operators. So that's d3p for 2 pi cubed 2ep. ap dagger di p dot x. And similarly for phi sub minus. So if you compare it to some references define, separate amount into components with a superscript plus or minus, and those are sometimes reversed. I find this definition to be easier because the plus has a plus in the exponent and the dagger makes more sense to me. Let's see if a few references do it this way as well. A word of warning if you're trying to compare what we're doing.
These two are still three vectors, right?
In the exponent, these are four vectors.
Okay.
So here, x is a four vector. This p, since it has a
arrow
vector, is a three vector. But this is evaluated with p 0 equals ep. Okay. And for this proof, since this quantity is going to show up a lot, I'm going to give it another name. This is also, this vacuum excitation value is also often referred to as the Feynman propagator. So I'm going to write it as delta F, x1 minus x2. And I'm going to make a claim, a further claim that delta F can be written in another way. Can be written in terms of a Heaviside function, delta beta of x naught minus y naught phi minus x, commutator phi minus phi plus. So we're going to compute this at the end, and what you'd expect is if you were trying to compute this vacuum expectation value, well, there'll be some terms where the annihilation operator is already acting in the vacuum, some terms where this creation operator is acting on the vacuum from the right, and the only terms that are going to be non-zero are where we use the commutator. So this formula should be plausible. Time permits, I'll say more about why this is exactly what we got at the end. But for now, I'm just going to assume that this is the expression for this propagator. Okay, so we're going to prove, or I'll sketch a proof of Wick's theorem using induction. So the simplest case of Wick's theorem is where we have two fields. And for two fields, if T1 is greater than T2, then this time-ordered product just gives us four terms, phi plus of x1, phi plus of x2, phi plus of x1, phi minus of x2, phi minus x1 plus x2, and phi minus. And most of these terms are already normal ordered. So Wick's theorem relationship between time ordering and normal ordering. And in fact, only one of these terms is not normal ordered. This one doesn't contain any annihilation operators. This one, the annihilation operators are already to the right. This one doesn't contain any creation operators, so those three terms are normal ordered. This one is not. It has annihilation operators to the left and creation operators to the right. So to normal order this one, we need to use the commutation relations. So we can write this. This one is not normal ordered. So what we get is the normal ordering, phi of x1, phi of x2, plus we have to use the commutator in order to put that term in the correct order, phi minus of x1, phi plus x2. And so that's for t1 greater than t2, so we get exactly this term. The time ordering was in the other order, then the order of operators would switch, and we'd need to use the commutator on this term to put it back in that order. So we get, if x, no, n is greater than x2, we get this, otherwise we get that. So that is exactly what we want. We see that for case of two fields, we get there's only two possible ways we can contract two fields. We can either not contract them or contract them. So we get this term from not contracting them, or delta f of x1 minus x2. If they are contracted. Yes.
So wait, is delta like a scalar or an
uppercase? This is an ordinary function. It's a function of the variables x1 and x2. It's not an operator.
So there you define it with the vacuum expectation value, and there it's.
Yes. These two expressions are equivalent. If you wanted to compute this, what you'd have to do is use the commutation relations. And so if x1 is greater than x2, then this is already in time order. And the only non-zero term in this vacuum expectation value will be the commutator of phi minus of x1 phi plus. The other terms will either have too many creation or annihilation operators, or have a annihilation operator acting on this vacuum, or creation operator acting on that vacuum. So we'll vanish. We'll go through this calculation in a few minutes, but they're equivalent.
I just wondering why you have it as a vacuum expectation value.
They're equivalent, so there's a number of different ways to write this. If I put the vacuum expectation value here, just to emphasize that this is actually not an operator anymore. This is not an operator either, even though it's commutator. Well, it's a commutator, but the commutator is just involves the delta distribution. Okay. So we're going to show Wick's theorem works for any number of fields. The natural way to do it is to use induction. And assume this works for n minus one fields. And in that case, I wanted to compute this for n fields. And assume that t1 for simplicity is greater than t2, greater than tn. It works similarly. In other cases, you'd have to relabel some things. We could. Write this as phi 0 of x1 times the time ordering of x phi 0 of x2 up to phi 0 of xn, which by Wick's theorem, we assume it works, is the sum of all contractions. The normal ordering of all contractions involving phi 0 of x2 up through phi 0 of xn. And what we would want to do if we want to put this term inside of the normal ordering, well, we can break it up into phi plus and phi minus. And well, this term we can just put inside of the normal ordering because it involves a creation operator, so it's already normal ordered. Um, this term, we're going to have to use the commutation relations to bring it all the way to the right past any creation operators, and this will create contractions. When you use the commutation relations to move it past the other operators. So I don't have to go through all the details, but that's the essential idea of why Wick's theorem is
true.
Okay, so we'll get these contractions will involve partial contractions, and so those partially contracted fields will be contracted with phi 1 by using the commutation relations here.
That means that it constitutes all possible contractions. What becomes of the plus term? So you can just take it inside of the normal ordering. But
So the plus term will give us all of the terms that involve phi 1 that is not contracted with anything. And the phi minus will give us all of the terms that involve contractions.
Can you explicitly write that down? Doesn't it?
So, for example, for example, if we have phi plus x1 phi minus of x1, and we assume it works for n equals 2. So for n equals 2, we know that this contractions would be phi 2, phi 3, plus delta f x2 minus x3. Just do induction going from, or assume it works for 2, go to 3. So we're, this is Wick's theorem for the 2. So this term is just phi of x1 times xf, and that will give us exactly this term. That's one of the terms where phi is, phi 1 is not contracted, phi 2 and 3 are. And then to normal order, put this normal order in here. So we can use the commutation relations of phi 1 with phi 2. That will give us a term like this. And we'll get this term, meaning commuting again, and then we'll be left with the completely normal order thing. We could generalize that if we had more fields over here. So we have almost everything we need. The last thing we need is a useful expression for the Feynman propagator. And so Feynman propagator one way to define it is in terms of this time-ordered expectation value of two fields. And also write this. Using the expansion of the field operators in terms of the creation and annihilation operators as this expression times e to the minus I e dot minus y. If x naught is greater than y naught. And this comes about just because, so if x naught is greater than y naught, then write this as integral v3p integral d3k for the lens invariant measure. And most of the terms will vanish. The only term that doesn't vanish is the term that has a AK dagger. And we'll have the appropriate exponentials for those terms, minus ip dot x plus I k dot y. So that's the only term that doesn't survive, that doesn't just vanish because it's acting in the vacuum, this term. And so if the only contribution is going to be this commutator. Commutator gives us a 2 pi cubed 2 dk delta t minus k, which kills off one of the integrals. So that's why we get this expression. If x naught is greater than y naught, and we'll get I'm going to pull out this vector 1 over 2EP here. We get the other sign in the exponent. If these operators in the other order, we just switch x and y. And to write this in a more useful form, we can note that this term can be written as 1 over 2EP e to the minus IP x minus y times theta y naught minus x naught. So what I've done is I've switched the sign in the exponent. So remember, we can switch the sign in the integral, and we'll switch the sign of the spatial components here. So this is OK as long as I evaluate this at, I haven't done anything as long as I evaluate this at p naught is equal to minus ep instead. And, well, these two terms can be combined. So follows. So we can write this as a contour integral. Minus 1 over p squared minus m squared minus I p dot x minus y. It's the following contour. It's the imaginary part p naught. It's the real part of p naught. Got this integrand has poles at plus and minus ep. And the contour we're going to use goes around the poles like this. And, well, to see that this expression is equivalent to this expression, we can think about which way we are allowed to close the contour, depending on if, depending on the sign and the exponent. So we want. We can close the contour and use the residue theorem in the upper half plane if y naught is greater than x naught. Because then this exponential will die off in the semicircle we add. And so in that case, we'll enclose this pole. And if we evaluate the residue, we'll just get back, in that case, exactly what we want, the 1 over minus 1 over 2 ep. And similarly, if x naught is greater than y naught, we should enclose, we should complete the contour in the lower half plane, and we'll enclose this pole, and we use the residue theorem, we'll recover the correct coefficient here. And so this expression can be written in another form. And also write this instead of shifting the contour away from the real line, we can shift our poles slightly away from the real axis. That's what this I epsilon indicates. And so this is going to be our most useful expression for the Feynman propagator. And so we've essentially got all of the ingredients we need in order to compute observables. So you saw how we can compute, relate cross sections into K rates, to matrix elements, which we can relate to vacuum expectation values of time ordered products of Heisenberg fields using the LHC reduction formula. Then we can relate that to interaction picture fields, which can then be related to the Feynman propagator by Wick's theorem, which gives us this. So we've got all the ingredients we need. And there's one key property of the Feynman propagator that will be useful when we put all the pieces together, which is what we'll do on Thursday. And that is that the Feynman propagator is a Green's function for the Klein-Gordon operator. And see that we can just act with the Klein-Gordon operator on the Feynman propagator. And what we get is so Simon propagator just hits the exponential and brings down a factor of p minus p squared from the derivative. And we have plus m squared e to the minus I p dot x minus y. And these factors cancel. We're left with integral p or p to I fourth of minus I of minus I p dot x minus y. This just gives us a delta. So we're left with minus I delta x minus y. This is a Green's function, and that will be useful when we put all these things together next time. Yes.
And that particular expression where we have computed the contour integral?
Yes.
That I epsilon, will that not depend upon the upward contour or the below, the lower contour? Where is that I epsilon?
That I epsilon, so implicit in that formula is that epsilon is a small parameter that we take to zero. So this formula is basically shifting so in this expression, the poles are slightly above the real axis and slightly below the real axis instead of on the real axis. In this expression, the poles are on the axis, but our contour is slightly deformed to go below or above. Here we're equivalently just putting our contour on the axis and slightly deforming the poles away from the axis. This expression and both expressions encompass both these cases. So in order to use the residue theorem, we need to have a complete contour that encircles some number of poles. And so whether we're allowed to complete our contour in the upper or in a useful way in the upper or lower half plane depends on the sine of x naught minus y naught, because we want the part of the contour that we add to contribute nothing to our integral. So if x naught is greater than y naught and p naught has a positive imaginary part, then we should enclose the contour down here so that this exponential goes to minus its exponential of minus infinity in a limit that p naught has a arbitrarily large magnitude.
But the contours for the two poles are different and actually opposite to each other. So why isn't it like something like we factorize the p squared minus m squared first into p minus m multiplied by p plus m and then applied plus I epsilon and minus I epsilon for each other so that there will be a different opposite shifting for two different poles? Because if we directly add epsilon to the whole term, it seems like both the poles are shifted to the same direction rather than to two different.
No, we'll be shifting them in opposite direction. So we can write, we've got 1 over E naught squared minus EK squared. We can write, as you were suggesting, as 1 over E naught minus EK, 1 over E naught plus EK. And if we add a plus I epsilon here, what we should do is take the square root of this expression, so that we'll shift them in different directions. So it would be we'd have here plus AI minus I epsilon over 2. And here it would be plus I epsilon over 2. We'd still want to complete the square. So we should treat this object as our new, this is the location of the roots of this will be the location of the roots. I'll be checking that proportion. We can discuss more after class. Okay. Are there any other questions?